from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Please direct me, Jim.
I think my name is Gary, and I'm an alcoholic. There's an old boy back home that sometimes gives me an adequate introduction. And he says I give an adequate talk, so that works. I don't think it's your day, Ron. Did somebody drive you down here or what? Sure want to thank the committee and everybody that's responsible for me being here. And I always kind of wonder where to start. It seems to me that there's an old line that's been around this program as long as I can remember that really kind of describes the shape I was in when I showed up here. It has to do with this old tomcat that had been out making love to a skunk for a while. He hadn't had all he wanted, but he sure as hell had all he could take. I'm really enjoying myself. One is you're all not smoking. I don't think you're enjoying it, but it's really great from this end. I can see all of you. I guess the things I remember most about my alcoholism, the sickness, have to do with long before I ever took my first drink. Because there were some things going on inside of me as a youngster that just kind of seemed to grow worse as I grew older. And I guess the best way to explain those is to tell you that I tried to grow up on an experimental farm outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming. And I used to watch the adults that were on this place, the men, and I would try or think I wanted to be like them if they'd let me grow up. I grew up around the cowboys and the roughnecks and oil patch and some horticulturalists and things in this place, and I'd watch them, and they seemed to be just what I wanted to be. But even as a little kid, I would look at them, and I'd watch them go to work every day, and I'd watch them take care of their families. And if they went to town on Saturday night and got into a beef, they managed to get it taken care of, and get home, and get to church on Sunday. And I'd watch them do this and think I really wanted to be that way, but there was something going on inside of my head that I knew I wasn't ever going to cut it. I just knew it. I don't know how else to explain it. And as I grew older and was attending school and that sort of thing, I'd kind of size up the rest of the kids in the class. And there was just something about me that wasn't like them. I couldn't describe it. I couldn't explain it to you what it was. But I was sitting in that class and it felt like I had a great big wart in the end of my nose. Y'all couldn't see it, but it was there. I knew it was there. Had to be. I just wasn't like them. I didn't belong. And of course, as I grew older, that seemed to get worse. And by the time I reached high school, as a sophomore in high school, it had gotten so bad that I couldn't talk to anybody. And I literally couldn't talk to my class. If I had to get out in front of the class and recite something or write something on the blackboard, forget it. Couldn't do it. My knees would start slapping and my tongue get all messed up, and I just couldn't do it. And I'd get so embarrassed and so flustered, I'd finally run out of the room. And they tried a whole bunch of things to get me to stick around in those classes. Not much of them worked. But I kept going back and kept trying to be a part of, and except for a very small number of kids, I didn't fit. And I really didn't fit with them, but I hung around with them anyway. God, I couldn't talk to girls. Boy, there was something about those pups I just couldn't handle. That was miserable. Anyway, as a sophomore in high school, three of us had gone over to Laramie for the state basketball tournament. And somewhere along that trip, we had picked up a fifth of Four Roses and some Coke. That's Coca-Cola, in case you're wondering. Well, you got to be careful what you say, isn't it? And somewhere or another, the two guys I was with picked up a couple of girls. And so us and the booze and the coke and the girls took off for a place known as the Ninth Street Hill. Now, you all had a Ninth Street Hill in your town, too. I don't know what you call it, but you got one. I got thinking about that a little later, you know. Here we had the booze in the car and the girls in the car, and we're heading for the boondocks, and we didn't know what to do with either one. Couldn't go down to the drugstore and buy those magazines to explain all that like you can now. Well, we started passing that jug around. And first time it went around, I did it right. I'd seen the big boys wipe it off. I haven't figured out this day why the hell we wiped them bottles off. And I took a slug and I passed the jug on. And it came around again. And this time I got a hold of that bottle and I turned it up and I got a lot of it. I kept it there until they took it away from me. And some remarkable things took place. You know, it was great. That feeling of not belonging and not being a part of that group of people in that car changed. Hell, I felt like I owned those people in that car. And you know, I even found that I could talk to one of those girls. Matter of fact, that one girl had a couple of points about her that just fascinated the hell out of me. And I made a very clumsy grab for her, and she liked to beat me to death. A little while later, they were going to sober me up, and so we went to a truck stop, and they were going to fill me full of coffee, I guess. And there was this cowboy out there, and I thought I could whip him, and he damn near did beat me to death. A little while later, everything was cool. I guess I had straightened up a little bit, and everything was great, and that girl had just put her head on my shoulder when I threw up on her. I had thoughts the way she had treated me earlier, she had it coming, but there wasn't any. I don't know what happened. Everything I'm telling you is secondhand to me because I really don't remember. I guess they put me to bed somewhere. But I remember the next morning because I didn't feel too sick. And I had always heard about all these hangovers and how bad people felt and all that. And I didn't feel that bad. You know, I really didn't. But it was kind of funny. I had to explain to these people. I had to go to great effort to explain to these people why I had behaved that way the night before. It wasn't necessary for me to drink that whiskey to learn to lie. I picked that up before I found whiskey. But after I found whiskey, I got good at it. The process of the alcoholic and his or her lying has amazed me since, I guess. Because I'd lay a story on you just to lay a line on you. You know, I'd just pick some story out of left field and tell you I'd been the greatest thing in the world or the worst thing. Didn't matter. And, you know, I'd tell you a lie when it was been smarter, simpler. Any way you can look at it would have been better for me to tell the truth. And I'd lie to you. Kind of like I was trying to stay in practice in case I really needed one, I guess. It amazed me. And it's funny, you know, just several years later when I stopped drinking, that lying didn't just go away because I stopped drinking. That required a little more than stopping drinking. At any rate, that, you know, that one story I've told you just pretty much relates my whole drinking career. That's the sum total of my social drinking, was that evening in Laramie. That was my social drinking career. I managed to get through high school because it reached the point just shortly after that, the memories of that night, I guess, I knew I had an answer. And so my problems in staying in high school after that were because they kept finding the bottles in my locker. And because I just had to have it just to kind of be a part of that high school, be a part of those people. And it was necessary for me. And I hated attention being drawn to me in class so much that I'd learned a way to stop that from happening. And I found out that teachers just don't call on you if you don't know any answers. You know, they just quit trying after a while. That dummy ain't never gonna give me an answer. So I graduated from high school with a grade I had worked very hard to get. I had a grade average of a D-. And I was damn glad to get it. Because I meant I was out. I didn't have to go back that place anymore. And I didn't want to. Somehow or another, I ended up in the Army. And let me kind of tell you one little story. I met one girl in high school. I think I was a sophomore and she was a freshman. That was the only girl I ever really got to talk to. I got to say I could say hi to people in the halls, but I could only talk to this one girl. And so naturally, we dated all the way through high school. I got out, and my dad and the chief of police thought it'd be real nifty if I went in the Army. They were extremely disappointed when I showed up back in town 6 months later. My Army career was damn near as short as my social drinking career. I ended up back in Cheyenne and looking for somebody to talk to, and naturally I found the girl I'd known how to talk to. That following September, we got married. That following January, we had a 8.5-pound baby girl that was 3 months premature. I swear, you all are a whole lot sharper than people up north. I told that up there, and they just sit there and look at me. By this time, what was going on inside of me, it kind of gotten to the point where I'd wake up in the morning, and it felt like I had a big hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it. And my hands would shake. And the only thing I knew to stop all that was booze, was alcohol. And my process got to be there that I would go down to the bar, and this was the days of counter checks. You know, you go in and tell a bartender, give me a check on such and such a bank. In my case, it didn't matter. I didn't have any accounts in any of them banks. So I'd normally go in and I'd write a bad check for a drink and go through the process of keeping the first drink down. And that was kind of went something like this. When I'd finally get one down, I'd feel a little better. You know, that hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it would settle down a little bit, and I'd feel a little bit up, maybe 10%. So you know, I'd have another drink, and in a little while, I felt a little better. You know, I was maybe up 30%. And after a while, I'd get to thinking I'm about 80% there, and if I have one more drink, I'm going to hit that really neat spot where everything's just super, and I can be anything I want to be. One more drink, and I can catch my edge, if you will. You know, I'd maybe write that bad check and get that one more drink, and damn, I'd be at 120%. And I'd be out doing my thing, which was not particularly fun. The end result of all that was by the time I was 24 years old, we'd had two more little girls. I had reached a place physically where I weighed something under 130 pounds. Now, I'm 6'2" tall and I weigh 200 pounds right now. Now, I'll tell you what, me at 130 skinny. If I walked fast, my legs whistled. It was. And I was no longer living at home. My wife had suggested I leave and had enough people there to back it up. And, and I had kind of had a morning that it started out like I told you. I went through that process of trying to get well in the morning, and but this one was a little bit different, this one particular morning. Other than I wrote the bad check for $5, but I just drank a beer, and that's all I wanted. And I had $4 and some change left, and I got into a liar's poker game with the four remaining dollar bills I had. And I couldn't do anything wrong that day. I'm not kidding you. I don't think I lost a hand that whole morning. And I'd turned that $4 into about $90 by noon. And I'd bought back my bad check I'd written. And the guy that owned that particular bar said he thought it'd be nice if I went and drank in some other bar. And so I did. I went up to one I'd hung out and had a bunch of bad paper up there. And so I went up and bought the bad checks back and tried to get another liar's poker game going, and they didn't want me in that bar either. So I thought, well, hell, I'll just try and get in the house. And I called Julie, and I said, I'd like to see the kid. And she went for it. Sometimes the Malinons are easy, aren't they? I don't know, did you all hear about the Al-Anon lady? Had this husband that was really bad to drink, and she'd started going to these Al-Anon meetings and getting all this wisdom and feeling better, and this one night he comes staggering in the door and just expecting the absolute worst. He's reaching for the doorknob, and she opens it up for him and invites him in just as sweet as she can be. Takes him over to his easy chair and sits him down and asks him if he'd like a drink. Yeah, I guess so. A little while later, she brings him into the kitchen and fixes him his favorite meal. I mean, the thing he'd rather eat anything, nothing else would be as good as this one. And afterwards, she takes him back to his easy chair and brings him a little wine for after dinner. And he's just sitting there loving it all and soaking it up. And she kind of disappeared for a while and left the room. She came back in her sexiest negligee. I mean, her very best. And she came out there and she sat down in the arm of his chair and showed him a little leg and says, would you like to go back in the bedroom with me? And he says, well, I just as well. I'm going to catch hell when I get home anyway. Every time I tell that, there's some guy out there that laughs harder than anybody else. I wonder why that is. And anyway, I did get in the house that evening, and I don't remember all the conversation, and I'd probably mess it up anyway. Every time Julie hears it, she tells me I tell it wrong, and I don't remember it the way she tells it, so I just kind of consider the source left. Generally let her tell it, but she's not here. She's home ill. She was planning to come, and Got the flu the other night and couldn't make it. But we got to talking about my behavior over the past few years, and she had reason to talk about it, because I had become everything that I despised. And I guess that's something I hope that's happened to every alcoholic in this room, because I believe it took that for me to get in here. I'd just simply become everything I despised, because by that time I was beating on her and I was beating on the kid, and I hated people that did that way. They weren't nice the way them cowboys operated out where I grew up. It just wasn't the way it happened. But we'd kind of gotten to talk about that, and the only thing we knew to do with alcoholics back there at that time was to send them to the Wyoming State Hospital, the Nut House. And it's in a town called Evanston. And I told Julie, well, I'll go there. I'll go there if your dad will haul me up there. I didn't think that was particularly out of line. Hell, it was only 500 miles. And he came out to the house and he says, well, I won't take you to Evanston, but I'll take you down to the bus depot. And then several months later, he told me when he took me down there, he didn't much care which bus I got on as long as it was leaving Cheyenne. But I somehow got on the right bus. And on the third day of December in 1964, I walked in the doors of that place. Well, there was a policeman walking in with me, but it was still what they termed a voluntary commitment. And some interesting things took place there, and it started the very first minute I walked in the door. First thing I was asked when I came in was if I had come there to take part in their alcoholic rehabilitation program. And I thought real quick, geez, I'm in a nut house and they're asking me if I want to be an alcoholic. And I said, you bet. Of course, that's where they put me, with the alcoholics, and I learned some things. Incidentally, I gave you the third day of December 1964 because that's my dry date. I haven't had a drink, or any of them pills, or any of them funny-looking cigarettes, or any of that garbage since. I can't really tell you what all happened in there, other than I learned to eat again. And I phrase it that way because that's exactly what happened. Apparently, I'd gotten out of the habit. Because I'd sit there and they'd bring that food into the ward I was on, and it looked great. You know, it was the potatoes and the gravy and the meat. It was looked super. But I somehow couldn't eat it. And I learned to eat. And I attended my first AA meeting inside there. And I can't say that I was particularly thrilled with that event. I kind of sized them up. Evanston's pretty close to Salt Lake City, and people would drive up from Salt Lake to carry the message. And they came in, and I'd look at them, and hell, I was 24 years old, and most of these guys looked like they were fresh out of Wrinkle City. And and they talked about things like God, and getting up and reading out of this little book and praying in the morning. And I says, come on, don't kid me. There ain't nobody that square. There ain't nobody does that. By golly, I didn't know anybody that did that in all my life. Certainly never happened around our house. Excuse me. I learned I was an alcoholic there. I can't say that I knew it before that, honestly. There have been plenty of people tell me that there was something wrong with the way I drank. But somehow I never related that to alcoholism up until that time. I think the most important thing that happened to me there, other than getting dried out and exposed to AA, happened to me one day when I was sitting down in the canteen drinking a cup of coffee with some of those alkies. And I heard myself telling them I didn't ever want to take another drink. And I thought about what I just said, and I thought, that's new to me. I've never had that thought in my life. I never knew it was possible to live without taking another drink. It never entered my mind. It was absolutely novel to me. And of course, that's the day I met the requirement to be a member of AA. I didn't want to drink anymore. It's kind of interesting because I was in there for 4 months and I got my physical health in pretty good shape. And I put me on a bus back to Cheyenne one night about 4 o'clock. And I knew I had all the answers for this thing. I just knew it for a fact. I thought you could sum it up in one statement, and that's don't swallow. Don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. Now, that's true. You know, it's just really difficult to get drunk if you don't take a drink. But I thought that was all there was to it. I figured I didn't have to listen much anymore, apparently, because I sure didn't listen much for a while. And I'm riding that bus back to that 500 miles to Cheyenne, and I hadn't been on it an hour, I don't believe, when something kind of started to take place in my life again. Because here I was, physically I was in better shape. I had a place to go when I got out of there. I had things to do when I got out of there. They had told me that if I wanted it, I could have a free ride to go to college. They'd take care of Julie and the kids and all the tuition and all that stuff if I just went to school. Of course, my option to that at that time was hunting for a job. And that just beat looking for a job. I was on that bus, everything going well for me, several weeks sober, and I had that hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it. It hadn't gone away just because I stopped drinking. And what I didn't realize then is I suffered from the disease of alcoholism at that time. A friend of mine in Chicago says I suffered from untreated alcoholism at that time. So kind of at this point, I kind of want to tell you about my treatment. Anyway, we did end up at the University of Wyoming. Went to school. There wasn't enough money available to support us all, so I had to work. And the way I went to college was, is I took as many semester hours as I could each semester, as they'd allow me. And I worked 35 and 40 hours a week. And to surprise to myself and many, many people in Cheyenne, I carried an excellent grade average. But I had to stay super busy. Because if I had a vacation from either school or work, I had time to be with me. And I didn't like that much. The hole in my belly and the wind blowing through it was incredible. And I still couldn't talk to people. I couldn't look them in the eye. I just couldn't do it. And I had classes that the professor would get up there and say, well, he says, one whole grade point's going to be determined by your class participation. And I'd think, you turkey, the best I can do in here is a B. And that's generally what I did. I got through school, and I ended up in Denver. And I started attending a few more AA meetings. AA meetings in Laramie were somewhat limited, and I suspect they still are. I haven't been back in years. But we had meetings on Mondays and Fridays. And that's when somebody else showed up. And I attended those meetings. I did going to school that way and not taking any vacations. You get through college in a hurry. And I did 4 years of college in 3 years. And I ended up in Denver. And I had a job with a big oil company that only lasted 40 hours a week. I had nothing but time on my hands. And I hadn't heard things that people in larger communities had been hearing for years. Nobody had ever told me you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I'd have had to travel about 12,000 miles to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I love West Virginia because it's somewhat rural. But I'm afraid you West Virginians don't know what rural is. A friend of mine got transferred from the Midwest out to Denver, traveling for a company. And he's taking his first trip through Wyoming. And he stopped in Casper. He's buying gas. And he asked the lady at the gas station how far it is to Gillette. And she said it's 113 miles. Now, this boy's from the Midwest, where there's a town every 5-6 miles, and he says, well, what's between here and Gillette? She said 113 miles. And very often the AA meetings were that far apart. And so I didn't get to much AA those years. But what I got to, I didn't hear. One of the things I never heard, and I don't believe it was said to me in 3 years in the program, that had to do that the program of recovery is to take the 12 steps in order. And you ought to do it the way the big book says. Nobody told me that. And I got down to Denver, and I'm scrambling because the pain is just, it's getting to me. The hole in my belly, wind blowing through, it's incredible. And here I am, this bright, young, intelligent guy out of college and sober and all that. And I got these jobs with oil companies and I can't keep them. I'm losing jobs as quick sober as I was losing them drunk. It never struck me they had trouble trusting someone that wouldn't look them in the eye. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't stand it, man. I knew they could see inside of me and see all that garbage turning over. I just knew it. I couldn't look them in the eye. If I was talking to you, I couldn't do it. And if you were talking to me, I really couldn't do it. I knew every scuff on my boots, but I couldn't look at you. And I went to a meeting down there this one time, and I found a fella in there I really liked. His name's Joe, and Joe had something I wanted. And what it was Joe could sit around and gripe better than anybody I knew. Now, he was good at it. He really was. He would sit there and kind of rewrite the first portion of the fifth chapter. He didn't see a reason we said that in front of every meeting. And he bellyached about a lot of things, and I liked that. And I started hanging around with him. And we were sitting over at his house one day and drinking coffee and bitching. And his wife came in and she says, "You two are probably the two sorriest people I know." That was an edit. And she says, "I just want you to get away from me. I don't care where you go or what you do. I don't care if you get drunk. Just get the hell away from me." And she says, "Why don't you try a different AA meeting? Why don't you do something different?" She says, "Why don't you go to the young people's group? They meet downtown on the skids there someplace. Why don't you go find that meeting?" And Joe stood up and stuck his chest out. And he says, "Yeah, Brian, let's do that." He says, "The broads there got to be better looking anyway." And that's why we went. And they were. But we got there that night. And I had a whole lot to learn. I thought that bunch of kids in that room had a lot to learn, but it was the other way around. Because most of the time I'd been going to AA for nearly 4 years, I'd attend a meeting, and somebody would come up to me and pat me on the back and say, "Gee, isn't it wonderful you got a hold of this thing at such an early age and didn't have to go through all the crap that we went through?" And I'd think, what else can I do to be a part of this outfit? I damn near died out there. I lost the home. I damn near lost my family. You know? I wrecked cars like most people step on bugs. And I owed money on every damn one of them. When I got sober and got to counting up all the money I owed, it was amazing. I owed all these thousands of dollars and I didn't owe it for anything. There weren't any new cars out there or new furniture. I just owed it. Anyway, I got 10 in this young people's group, and they didn't pat me on the back. They did a lot wrong in my mind, and I tried my very best to explain to them that I had damn near 4 years sober, which was probably seniority in the room, and they ought to listen to me. And I said some absolutely wonderful things in there. God, I don't see why they didn't kill me. I really don't. I remember a night I said, you know, they were talking about one of the steps. And I said, You know, I don't see what we're going to all this trouble for. It doesn't matter what step you're taking, just reach up there and grab one. Don't matter none. Two things were said to me before the night was over. One of them was said by an old woman from Gillette, Wyoming, now that I think about it. She said to me, she says, Gary, she says, the reason they got numbers in front of them steps is so dummies like you know which one to take next. This little bitty guy came up to me, he looked up at me, and he says, you can go ahead and try to do this program that way if you want to. The worst thing will happen to you, you'll find out it don't work. And if you should survive that, if you should live through that, you might want to try it the way we do it. A little while later, they started another meeting that met in the homes. And they decided they wanted to go through the big book together. And so that's kind of what we did. The Denver Young People's Group at that time was made up of some strange individuals. We consisted of some cowboys down from out of the mountains, some Mexicans down from out of the mountains, some kids right off the street. I remember two guys that were trying to stay sober and hold down a job as cashiers in a porno shop. Huh. All the trouble we have was fantasy anyway. That ought to be. But we were just a rather unusual bunch to even be sitting together, as perhaps we all are here tonight. But we started this meeting in homes, and we started reading out of the big book. And there was a night when I read, when we read, the very first page of the third chapter. And there's a line in there that when I read it, it was like somebody had given me the keys to the kingdom. And all that line simply said was that we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step to recovery. The delusion we are anything like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. And I literally felt wonderful. All my life I'd known I wasn't like other people. Remember the wart? I wasn't like them. And the reason was is I was an alcoholic. And when I went home that night, there was something different about the house. It took a little while, but I understand now that what happened essentially that night was the first step came to me in its entirety. I had reached the point where I knew beyond a shadow of doubt that everything I had tried and done for 4 years hadn't worked. I hadn't drank, simply by the grace of God. I remember days sitting in Laramie where I'd literally grab the arm of his chair and my knuckles would turn white and I'd say, God, I don't want to take a drink. Please don't let me drink. I knew what the first half of the first step was. And all of a sudden it struck me that my life was indeed unmanageable and that it had nothing to do with getting to work in the morning. It had nothing to do with me tying my shoes. My unmanageable life had to do with the hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it. Just because I stopped drinking, I can't manage that away. I can't do it. And I discovered that night that I don't even have the power to take steps by myself. And it set me free. Because it struck me that I don't have to manage my life no more. Because the rest of this program has to do with me finding a manager that's going to take care of it for me. We read on in the big book. We read in the fourth chapter on the second step. And I'd been in AA quite a while by then, nearly 4 years. And I'd seen some really sick pups come into this outfit. And somehow I'd watch them, and they'd grow right past me. Oh, they would. It was incredible. These were people that had tried everything in the world to get sober, and it hadn't worked. No human power had helped them. And they started hanging around these AA meetings and taking steps and doing that, and they grew up. They were getting their family situation straightened out. Now, they weren't getting back with them, maybe, but they were paying the alimony. Their lives were becoming in order. And they were holding their jobs, and they could speak to a group, and they could do all these things that I couldn't do. And it just simply struck me one day that God had done that. No human power could have done it. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity by watching him do it with other drunks. That's just how it happened. And I would watch people that had tried everything on this earth to get sober. All the drying out places and the nut houses and all of those things. Had a experience last weekend. I was down in North Carolina. And there's a town down there called Mount Airy. Well, we had a nut house in Denver called Mount Airy. And it was one time, it was one of these places where they treated alcoholics by the aversion treatment, or revulsion treatment. You know what I mean, Larry? It's medieval. If you don't know what it is, don't go to a hell of a lot of trouble finding out. A friend of mine went in there when he was 19 years old. He was bad to drink at that time. And they put him in a mirrored room in a barber chair. And there's a stainless steel pot that swings over in front of whoever's sitting in that chair. And there's shelves all around the room with all different kinds of liquor on them. And what they had done is they had given Tom some antabuse and set him in that chair and swung that pot around in front of him and said he could have anything he wanted to drink. Of course, the cure was is he'd get to sit there and watch himself puke in those mirrors and his toenails curl and his eyes cross, you know. And he would be so revulsed by the whole thing, he'd never take another drink. Several years later, Tom told me that worked. It really had. That he'd not had reason or excuse to take antabuse since. We got to reading in the big book in the fifth chapter about taking our third step. And we read about the actor and we did all those things. And we got down to where there's a third step prayer in the big book. It was funny because none of us had ever seen it there before. But it was. And one of the guys in the group says, you know, it seems to me, as long as I've been around AA, that most everybody I know that comes in here seems to drop out at the third grade. He says, they don't seem to ever go on, and they generally cop out by saying, I could never take an inventory because I haven't taken the third step. He says, why don't we get up and join hands and read / pray this third step prayer together? And he says, that way, if you all hear me saying that I can't go on with the inventory because I haven't taken the third step, you can call me a damn liar because you saw me do it. And so that's exactly what we did. Now, this was back in the 60s, and it was not common for a room full of men to stand up and hold hands. And I guarantee it wasn't common for this bunch to hold hands and pray. But we did. And it seemed to have the desired effect. Now, there was one fella that attended these meetings I didn't like much. And his name is Ernie. And Ernie's a big, good-looking Mexican fella who attended the meetings there. He'd come up from down south somewhere, and he would go to the meetings, and I'd sit there and watch him, and there was just something about him I didn't like. And there was something about me that he didn't like. And that wasn't unusual for me and Ernie's, but the way we handled that was, in this time, this was, again, the late 60s, and the sign of the time was the peace sign. And so Ernie and I had to let the whole group know that we really loved each other, because you love everybody in AA, right? Okay. And that's what we do. You know, we just see each other across the room and give them the peace sign. Now, the only problem with that is Ernie's missing this finger. And that was only one reason I didn't like him. Ernie's a good-looking guy, and every once in a while he'd walk into an AA meeting. And I remember this one time, there were these two ladies sitting there when he walked in. And one of them leaned over the other and says, "Geez, when Ernie comes in the room, it just takes my breath away." And I thought, that son of a bitch. Ernie disappeared for a while. He didn't show up to meetings for 5-6 weeks. And people were asking what happened to Ernie, and I'd say, "Don't knock it, he's gone." Really hope nobody went looking for him. But he came back. And I remember the night that he came back, because he walked in the room and there was something different about him. Couldn't explain it. He was a different person. It was Ernie. Looked like him. There was something different. He walked in the room, he sat down, he looked at people, and I looked him in the eye for a second. And what was different is when I looked him in the eye, there was somebody home. And I hadn't seen anybody in there before. And he got to telling us that he'd been gone for a few weeks because he'd been down in Texas. Down in a place where there's a big lake down there. And he'd gotten in trouble at home and gotten scared and he'd ran. And he'd gone to Texas down there and got around a bunch of AAs and they sat on him to start taking steps. And they had him write an inventory. And one day after he'd done that, this fellow named Bob took him out on the boat out in the middle of the lake. He shut the key off and he put the key in his pocket and he says, "Ernie," he says, "why don't you tell me what you wrote down in that inventory?" "Ernie can't swim." And of course he took a fist out. And when he came back to Denver, there was somebody home. Something had changed and I could see it. It was real. We were reading about the inventory in the big book in our little meeting. But one night shortly after that, I went home and I took out my pad and my pencil and my big book and I started to write an inventory. And I wrote all night, literally. The sun was coming up in the morning. And I discovered some things about myself I wasn't ever going to tell nobody. Lady in Denver calls that take to the grave stuff. And I discovered some things. I guess I'll share a couple of them with you. One of them had to do with my not belonging and not being a part of and not knowing much about people. And the best way I can explain that is take you back to that nut house where I met a man named Dale. Dale's retarded. Dale is physically the biggest man I've ever met in my life, and the strongest. I never saw him do it, but I'm told that when they had him working down in the dairy barn there at the nut house, a cow would go get in the wrong stanchion, they'd just call Dale, and he'd go move the cow. He'd pick it up and put it in the right stanchion. And I believe that, having seen him and been around him. But Dale wanted to be a part of so bad, he'd come into the canteen. And he'd come walk in and sit down at the table, generally with the drunks, and he'd say, "I worked out in the dairy barn today and I milked me some cows. How do you like me for that?" "I worked up in the canteen or in the cafeteria today and I washed off some trays. How do you like me for that?" And we'd just kind of sit there and laugh at him a little bit. And Christmas time came up and Dale got to go home for Christmas. And when he was pulling up to the ranch up there. He jumps out of the pickup and the family reunion's going on and everybody's hugging and kissing and Dale is so excited just to be a part of this thing. It's just great. And his little sister comes up to him and he picked her up and he hugged her and he crushed her to death. And of course they did the right thing and threw him in the truck and slapped the chains on him and hauled him back to the nut house. And it was several weeks before we saw Dale again. And one day he was back down in there. And he came up to us and he had an old Christmas package. It was all torn up. And he says, "Looky here." He says, "My grandma sent me some new drawers for Christmas. How do you like me for that?" I don't know what I said to him then, but I think today I could tell him I like him pretty good. But I think I kind of understand that desire to be a part of something and know I belong there. The other thing had to do when I discovered in my inventory, I was looking at my fears is what I was looking at. You know, the big book says we list our fears there, and that's kind of what I was doing, and I'd written down that I was afraid of people and that I was particularly afraid of girls. And the more I got to thinking about that was, I'd always been so tall, so skinny. I've always looked much younger than my real age. And I was afraid of girls. And it seemed to be to me, anybody that tall, that skinny, that afraid to talk to girls, and that pretty just had to be queer. And that's how it came down. That's what it felt like. I had no reason to think that, but that's what I thought. I was terribly afraid I was gay. And I don't say that for any impact or to embarrass anybody that may be here that is gay. That's not why it's done. And I hope that didn't happen. But it was a real fear with me. Short time later, there was four of us going to a little AA conference in the southeast part of the state. And a town called Lamar. We'd left a day late because we had to work on Friday night. So we're driving down there on a Saturday morning. And we missed a turn, and we showed up late. By the time we got there, there was only two rooms left, which meant we had to take on a roommate. And I was really hoping my roommate was going to be Mary. I got Ernie. And he saw that inventory when I opened up my suitcase. And he started leaning on me a little to take a fifth step. He says, "Gary, you're crazy if you don't do it tonight or this weekend." He says, "You're here with some of the finest sobriety in the state. Most of them believe in taking the steps in order, and most of them have heard fifth steps before." He says, "It's a wonderful opportunity. Please don't pass it up." And so I sized up everybody else at that conference and decided it wasn't anybody I liked there any better than I did Ernie. And so we ended up back in the room, and here I'm telling the most macho individual I've ever met in my life that I'm afraid I'm gay. Well, you all haven't lived unless you've tried that. And it took him a while to get me to tell him that. I had tried to shut that fifth step down several times before it got to that. But I just knew it was going to blow him away. Man, this is just flat going to wipe him out. He sat there and nodded his head and picked his nose and really shook him up. And he nodded his head and he said, "Yeah, I had them same fears." So I felt the same way. I handled it a little differently than you did. Much to the delight of many women in southern Colorado, he handled it differently than I did. That following morning, for some reason, they asked me to get up and talk at that conference for a little 10-minute talk. And I took longer than 10 minutes, and I told my story up until this point. And after the talk, a lady came up to me, and she said, "I think it seems to me, Gary, I've known you since you came to Denver." I said, "Yeah, I think you have." She said, "There was really something different about you today." She says, "I think you told the truth this time." She's dead right. I'd been lying in AA just like I'd been lying anywhere else. Hadn't stopped that just because I got some. I went home after that little conference and got to looking at my big book. It said we had to review our first five proposals, see if we've done them right. And so I started taking a look at it, and it seemed to me that I ought to go down to the young people's group and try to clean up all those lies I've been telling all that time. And I did. That was almost as hard, or maybe it was harder than the fifth step. But I did that, and then that Tuesday night I went home. I did step 6 and 7, like the book says. The book doesn't say much on step 6 and 7, because I believe that's all there is to it. It only takes a few minutes. And I always try to tell my story to this point because there's something important about that weekend. And what it is that's the weekend my life changed. That's the weekend the hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it started to grow shut. And I can honestly stand here and say to you that over the years since that time, I've not hurt like I used to hurt since. That hole in my belly, wind blowing through it, ended and back. I'm not telling you that I haven't been afraid since then. And I'm not telling you that I haven't done some damn fool things since then, because I have. But I haven't hurt like I used to hurt since that time. Now, what was going on in that group while I was doing all the same thing I just told you, the other guys in the group were taking steps themselves. And the end result was is we all went through the steps at about the same time. We were at the same point. And we'd get to the meeting, we'd read in the big book, and we'd share what had happened with us. Or maybe something we discovered at inventory, or whatever it was, and we'd share it, and we'd go along. And the meeting became a kind of workshop. We didn't call it that, but that's what it became. And when we got into the amend steps, we did some things I've never heard of being done anywhere else. But some of us had some pretty harsh things to make amends for. And some of us went with the guy that had to make the amend to do it. He'd be too afraid to go try it, and we'd say, well, I'll go with you if you'd like. But it's important that you get that amend made. And we'd do that, and we'd do it together. And we went on into the steps 10, 11, and 12 together, and we tried to practice those in a manner that we only did it for a short time, a few months, but I believe those were probably the few happiest months in my sobriety. But one of us would mess up, and we'd think of step 10, and we'd call somebody else. And whoever we called would ask us where we had been. Resentful, or afraid, or selfish, or dishonest. Then they'd ask us if we owed an amend. And then they'd ask us if they should go with us to make that amend. And very often we ended up that night down at Denver General Hospital on detox ward talking to an alcoholic. What we had done is taken the instructions on step 10 out of the big book verbatim and tried to do them just like that. We didn't try to interpret them, we tried to do them. And I started thinking about praying and meditating. I think I've probably screwed with 11th step more than anything else in this program, trying to get it right. You know, from trying to hold your hands just like it shows in the praying hands. Have you all tried that? Got to reading these books on meditation. And I remember reading this one where the kind of gave you pretty explicit instructions. And the first one was to go in and get comfortable. So I'd go in and sit down somewhere. And then the next one would say is to clear your mind. You tried that? The way my mind goes, that's tough. So anyway, I'd do that. I'd go in and I'd sit there and I'd kind of clear my mind and I'd shut my eyes and I'd just get real holy. And I'd be there just really getting holy when a naked brother goes. Then I didn't feel holy, I felt guilty. I've quit playing games with that step anymore, and I don't do anything fancy. I generally read the big book for a while, or the Bible, fully aware that the Bible's not conference approved. And I just say some prayers and I try to be quiet. And I try to do it again at night before I go to bed. And it seems to work pretty well. I want to tell you a little bit about what it's like now, and then I'll sit down. My entire sobriety, or if you will, my activity in the program, for the most part, has been taking steps in groups since that first time we did it. I have no idea how many times I've done that. We just finished our second workshop in Indianapolis, the first one we started last October. It finished and five guys left that one and went out and started five more. And they got started, and it's just all over Indianapolis now, the way it had been all over Denver for years. Matter of fact, Bob, since the International, we heard about that from the Canadian. I don't know how to explain that, but have you not taken the steps with somebody else? You've missed one of the greatest joys that this life has to offer. Because you get friends you just can't believe you could possibly have. It's the niftiest thing that ever happened. And I guess that's the thing that I enjoy most about AA. As much as I love being a ham and getting up and doing these things, I'd rather be home in somebody's basement taking steps with those guys. Every time I've done it, my life has changed. It's gotten better. Every time. And every time I've done it, I've found some dishonesty and some fear and some garbage that I haven't touched in all those years I've been taking anybody. And every time I do it, I get to go through the joy of sharing that with somebody else and watch them nod their head and pick their nose. Julie and I ended up in Indianapolis 4 years ago, almost exactly 4 years ago, just to show that I hadn't gained complete sanity. I left Denver, Colorado to move to Indianapolis, Indiana. And I gave up a partnership in the business. Only job I ever had in my life for over a few months. Really was. Just after I finished that first time with the steps, I got fired from the job I was working on. And I got recruited to go to work in a business I didn't ever dream I'd work for and didn't particularly want to. I tripled my income within 2 years in that new business. After 3.5 years business, I ended up the president of the company and a 50% owner. 4 years later, I gave it all up and moved to Indiana on a flyer, on a promise, and not too dependable a promise, because we ended up in Indiana flat broke. When I came into AA and I had to sit there in that nut house and listen to those old boys talk about everything they had lost in AA, I would sit there and I'd think, geez, I'm in the room with a bunch of has-beens. And I'm a never was. About 3 years ago, I had a damn good chance to be a has-been. We about lost it all. Wasn't all entirely my fault, but I was dishonest enough with the way I deal with money. And staying honest with my wife about our income and that sort of thing, I about blew it. It was that simple. And we were terribly homesick. We had such a cocoon of friends in Denver, in AA, that we were around all the time. Bill and Bob and I have been talking about one of them. We were tighter than fleas. We were together all the time. And they weren't there. We didn't know that many people in Indiana. Then pups couldn't hold an AA meeting right if they wanted to. We went to our first meeting in Indianapolis down the south side. There's a speaker meeting. This old boy got up and he says, "I'm Al and I'm an alcoholic." And Julie and I said, "Hi, Al." The whole damn group turned around and looked at him. Julie and I'd hold hands when they said the Lord's Prayer and got accused of trying to start a prayer meeting. That's till I explained to them that the reason we held hands in the young people's group was to protect the kitty. Our oldest girl, who for a number of years had just been the light of my life, she finished high school that first year in Indy and says, "Dad, I don't want to be a Hoosier." And her boyfriend came, got her, and they went back to Denver. And, of course, they're married and living out there. Got by the next year with reasonably little trouble, and the middle daughter graduates from high school, and 2 months after that, she comes in and tells me she's pregnant. She had a lot of fear when she did that, because she seen me stone sober stomp a piece of furniture to little bits. And I know she didn't know what to think. When she told me that, and I think from the time she told me that, and her mother, that she had no longer had any doubt in her mind that she was going to get anything but love and support from the two of us through the whole thing. She didn't know if she wanted to marry that guy or not. And she later did, and it didn't work out, and they moved. Well, the following January, I became grandpa. There is probably, living in my house right now, the best-looking little boy to show up east of the Mississippi in 75, 80 years. I'm not bragging. I can prove it. I got pictures. Anyway, that's all working out. But we had a 15-year-old at that time that had been hell on wheels ever since I first met her. And I first met her the day I got home from the nut house. She'd been around for her then, but I don't remember. And that's the truth. My first memory of Tracy is I'm 4 months sober, fresh out of a nut house. And at that time, she's a little over 8 months old. I don't know what we did as parents. I don't know how we treated her any differently. A couple years ago, she was into drugs and booze, having all kinds of troubles everywhere she turned, with school, with the police. I was getting well acquainted with the local sheriff and the guidance counselor at school. I didn't particularly like either one of them. A year ago last June, she's facing a felony rap. And we didn't know what to do. We tried everything. Listened to all advice from our friends in AA and people that have been through the same thing. And mostly we got told to stay on your knees and hang in there. Made some tremendous mistakes. Up until a year ago last June, I hadn't thrown a punch at anybody since I'd gotten sober. But I came unglued one night and knocked her about 14 feet. She was deaf in one ear for 6 months after that. She's facing a felony rap, and there's this fellow at the sheriff's office who I don't have any idea what he said to her or anything else. But she didn't have to go to jail. And the next few weeks were just miserable because you couldn't look at her and she'd start crying. You couldn't say zip to her. She'd just come all apart. One day she asked if she could go back to Cheyenne and see her grandparents for a while and maybe run down to Denver and see her sister. We thought, fine. We didn't have a dime. We didn't have any way in the world to send her down there. We did scrape up enough for a bus ticket. Didn't particularly want her to go across country on one of those buses, but we were willing to do it if she wanted to. She was supposed to catch a bus at 3 o'clock that afternoon that Julie called the airlines just out of the blue. And that particular day, Ozark Airlines introduced their first flight from Indianapolis to Denver, and the price of a plane ticket was $2 less than Greyhound's. She went out there and was gone for a while. I don't know what happened, and I'm afraid to ask. And I don't think her sister would tell me. But her boyfriend picked her up at the airport when she flew back in. And she walked in the house, I really didn't recognize her. I had a flashing thought for an instant he'd picked up the wrong girl. I'm serious. And I looked at her and she didn't look the same. There was really something different about her. And I looked her in her eye and there was somebody home. And I'd never seen anybody there before. She's just had the best year of her life that I've seen. Over a year now. She really has. She's gotten the best grade she's ever gotten in school. Now, she's not going to capture many honors, but she was much like me, and she's doing a whole lot better. And she's held down little jobs this time while she's going to school, and she bought herself a little car. It's a beat-up old Vega. It looks like a wreck looking for a place to happen. She loves it. And I got skinned up knuckles just trying to keep that turkey running because I'd hate to see her lose. Well, she's done fine. The reason she's done fine is there must be a God, because I'm here and Tracy's here. And that little boy lives in my house. And the biggest reason I know there's a God is because you people showed him to me. This God that loves us has just given us a way of life that's probably just beyond any of my expectations. I may lead you to believe that I think that all magic to this program's in the steps. I firmly believe we must take the steps. But I believe the power and the love all comes from God. And it's shown to me every time in a room like this with people like you. And I'm really grateful for this opportunity. I really am. Because if nothing else, you need to remember, anything I said is all you got to go out of here knowing is that this program really works. You don't ever have to hurt like you used to hurt again. Thank you very much.